In our podcast, we're going to be focusing on colonialism and how it links to and affects state legitimacy. Particularly, some ideas explored will be how state legitimacy is perceived in both the eyes of the colonizer and the colonized states, as well as the colonized states' relationships with one another given their colonial legacies.
Drawing specifically on Glenn Coulthard's piece, Subjects of Empire, Indigenous Peoples and the Politics of Recognition in Canada, we'd like to show essential links between the politics of recognition, colonialism, and state legitimacy and how Coulthard's themes of recognition and what it entails can be linked to the modern case studies. Through this, we are going to be looking specifically at aspects of Coulthard's piece, such as the idea of granting recognition stripping subjects of autonomy, the imposition of state power to negate the recognition of sovereign nationhood, and the recognition of the legitimacy of a state as a whole.
Our podcast will be divided into three case studies that we feel all express both colonialism and how recognition plays into state legitimacy in quite similar ways. The first case study will focus on India and Pakistan, with a specific emphasis on Pakistan's recent attacks on the Indian state of Kashmir. Second, the Israel and Palestine conflict will be explored. Lastly, we will focus on Russia and Ukraine, which exhibit the same themes but have an interesting geopolitical twist. Hey guys, I'm Karen. I'm going to be presenting the first case study under our theme of colonialism and the struggle of recognizing state legitimacy among colonized states. Particularly, I'm going to be focusing on the long-standing Indian-Pakistan conflict over territoriality of Kashmir. To give a little background context to help us understand how and why both states continue to fight over Kashmir today, I'm going to start in 1947 when the former state of Hindustan was divided by Britain into India and Pakistan. When the two countries won their independence from Britain in 1947, the Indian Independence Act included a partition plan that had given Kashmir the choice to join either India or Pakistan. Hari Singh, the Hindu Maharaja, which is the local king of the area, chose for a long time to rule Kashmir independently, recognizing that the state's Muslim population would be marginalized upon joining India, and the state's Hindu and Sikh populations would be marginalized upon joining Pakistan. Eventually, in 1947, Hari Singh chose to join India with specific conditions that Kashmir would be protected by India, but that Kashmir would be essentially sovereign in its own governmental abilities so that the people of Kashmir could vote on their political status in the future. Thus, the complicated ownership of Kashmir was similar to what we have seen in Quebec history and the separatist movement, a nation that wants to run its own governmental operations and is not technically a part of the constitutional legal system, but still wants to somewhat be part of the bigger state for protection and other benefits. Since Hari Singh's decision of Kashmir to join India rather than Pakistan, the two countries have fought three wars over the territoriality of Kashmir: the Indo-Pakistani Wars of 1957 and 1965, and the Kargil War in 1999. Outside of official wars, the two countries have been fighting since the partition, oftentimes rather violently, for the full ownership of Kashmir. The international community and organizations such as the UN have stepped in on a number of occasions in hopes of ending the fight. While Kashmir is an Indian state, it's similar to the state of Punjab in the sense that part of Kashmir falls within the Pakistan border and part of it falls within the Indian border. Thus, within both countries, there is a Kashmir that has been split with the partition. Approximately 43% of Kashmir falls under Indian rule and on the Indian side, whereas 37% of the region is the responsibility of Pakistan. China administers the rest. Yet throughout these conflicts, the state of Kashmir on the Indian side has been more than discontent with being a part of India rather than Pakistan. In fact, Kashmir is one of the most heavily militarized regions in the world. Some of the conflict boils down to issues of sovereignty, autonomy, and self-determination in Kashmir. In the 1970s and 80s, the Indian government introduced, and some argue imposed, British-style democracy and democratic principles within the state of Kashmir, most of which had been rejected. Yet these rejections of democracy led to the rise of Kashmiri insurgency in 1988, particularly violent insurgency that called for separation from India. On the other hand, the conflict can also be attributed to religious differences between the general majority and the leadership, as well as differential treatment to some religious groups. In the 1940s, 77% of Kashmir's population were Muslims, yet they were subject to several forms of discrimination, human rights abuses, legal infringements, and even genocide under Hindu and military rule, all of which again began contributing to the Muslim majority's preference for Pakistan, an Islamic state that echoed promises of not only religious freedom to be Muslim, but for security of Muslims. The rise of Kashmiri insurgency has further contributed to a number of terrorist attacks in the Indian state over the years, with Indian government officials and law enforcement being primary targets. According to the UN, Pakistan has also played a large role in the violence in Kashmir, with its government's support and encouragement of Kashmiri terrorism in hopes of winning Kashmir. Further, the 30-year-long insurgency has caused for generations of Kashmiris to be raised in militant and alienated lifestyles, including school education for children to learn how to use guns, how to attack Indian government and military, and how to believe that India is an occupying power over them. While peace talks were being negotiated in 2014, all hell broke loose in 2016 protests, the People's Democratic Party coalition falling apart in 2018, and the latest suicide bombings just last month. Over 40 Indian paramilitaries were killed in a suicide bombing in Kashmir by an attack believed to be committed by Jaish-e-Mohammed, where the suicide bomber detonated a vehicle full of explosives. On the 26th, India launched airstrikes on Pakistan's side of Kashmir at the Jaish-e-Mohammed group's base that led to the shooting down of Indian fighter jets and capturing of the Indian pilot by Pakistan on the 28th. One might say that these events relate to our theme of colonialism and the struggle for recognizing state legitimacy, because the roots of this conflict are in the colonial powers' decision to split Hindustan into a Hindu state and a Muslim state. Similar to Israel and Palestine, both religious groups could have their own nation. I also then wonder if the British's push for democracy in India and then India's push for it in the state of Kashmir have also been used as a colonial tool to assert European dominance and Orientalism. But in terms of recognizing state legitimacy, both Pakistan and India continue to disagree on who the state of Kashmir fully belongs to, as well as who it should belong to. Kothard's politics of recognition come into play in this conflict in two different ways. First, India and Pakistan's failure to recognize each other as legitimate states have caused negotiations and peace agreements to fail time and time again. While India has ownership of the part of Kashmir that falls on their side of the border, Pakistan does not agree with these claims, regardless of the accession signed by Harry Singh in 1947. On the other hand, India does not see Pakistan as a legitimate state and considers them to be riddled with terrorism and has called for international help from the UN in previous situations and has most recently urged the international community to isolate Pakistan for their continued terrorism. Without taking sides, both of these acts cause both states to have reduced notions of legitimacy and authority. Secondly, Kothard's politics of recognition can be viewed when it comes to the Indian government and the Kashmiri people on the Indian side of the border. While the Indian government considers them a part of India, the people of Kashmir have made it clear that they do not want to be part of India. In this situation, it seems that India does not recognize Kashmir as a nation despite the conditions laid out in the original accession. Thus, Kashmir is not treated as a nation and the people are denied the self-determination, sovereignty, and autonomy that they feel they deserve. The failure of Kashmir to establish their own form of Muslim government plays a role in their damaged notions of self-determination, causing frustration in the general majority of the population. As well, legitimacy of Kashmir as a nation is stripped when they need their legitimacy and autonomy to be granted to them by the state of India or by the state of Pakistan. Some may also argue that India and Pakistan are both colonizing powers derivative of and inspired by the British, preventing Kashmir's sovereignty as a nation. On the other side, the Kashmiri people do not see India as a legitimate state and do not respect the Indian government or military. As I've explained, in Kashmir, even from a young age, children are taught to defy the Indian government and treat them as though they are occupying their territory. In the following portion of the podcast, Stephanie will be explaining an interestingly similar case study between Israel and Palestine, so please be sure to be watching for links to the India and Pakistan conflict.
Now moving on to case study 2, Israel and Palestine. Beginning in the early 20th century, an increasing Zionist movement and a marked increase in Arab nationalism, coupled with the May 1916 Asia Minor Agreement, which divided Ottoman Arab states, created the borders of the Middle East as we have known them for a century. With the collapse of the Ottoman Empire after World War I, the League of Nations divided the former Ottoman territory into mandates, Syria and Lebanon to France, and Iraq and the newly created Palestine to Great Britain. Leading up to and after World War II, there was a great migration of Jewish people into the Palestinian land, and in February of 1947, Great Britain requested to find a solution of peace for Palestine. The United Nations Special Committee on Palestine was formed. The partition plan, which separated Palestine between the Arabs and the Jewish people, allowed for the formation of a Jewish state. Sympathy for the Jewish people was at an all-time high following the Holocaust. The partition plan was voted in favor of 33 votes yes, 13 votes no, and 10 absentees. In May of 1948, Israel declares independence, and the next day the first Arab-Israeli war begins. This war creates over 700,000 Palestinian refugees, which prompts the UN to create the United Nations Relief Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in 1949. The creation of the PLO, or Palestine Liberation Organization, happens in 1964, and in June of 1967, the Six-Day War begins, which creates an additional 255,000 refugees. The Yom Kippur War in 1973 was particularly important, did end in ceasefire due to USA and Russia both having vested interest in each country. This ceasefire emphasizes Coulthard's idea that recognition only benefits those who do the recognition and does nothing for the oppressed. The formation of Hamas in 1987 led to their published charter calling for the destruction of Israel. From there was many years of inconsistencies and non-peace. In June of 2009, American President Barack Obama endorses a two-state solution in his Cairo speech, which reinstated the importance of backing a Palestinian state while also reaffirming the USA's unbreakable bond with Israel. September of 2016 saw the USA sign a security deal with the Israeli army that provides them with $38 billion over 10 years, with the ultimate goal of having all that money spent on American military industry. February of 2017, President Trump supported a one-state solution, which is a drastic change from the five decades of two-state support dating back to the Reagan years. December of 2017, Donald Trump officially recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's capital and orders the American embassy to be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, to which the Israeli prime minister said he would be forever grateful. This recognition ties back to Coulthard's statement that recognition only benefits those doing the actual recognition and does nothing for the oppressed. There is no benefit for the subaltern, only the colonizing powers reach any rewards. The imposition of power and its effects can be seen throughout the relationship between these two countries. Paying attention to the Asia Minor Agreement and the partition plan, which was decided for the countries with no input from the actual people themselves. Coulthard mentions that an asymmetrical relation of recognition can impede human freedom, and this is seen thoroughly in both Israel and Palestine. Mutual character of dependence rarely exists between hegemonic and subaltern countries. The importance of self-recognition is emphasized by Coulthard, and this collective self-recognition without colonial power will be one of the only things that will lead to a lasting change between these two countries.
Moving on now to case study number 3, Russia and Ukraine. As a brief reminder, in 1991, Ukraine declared independence from the USSR. Crimea went from being part of the Russian Soviet Socialist Republic to part of the Ukrainian SSR. And then after the declaration of independence, 1991, Crimea became an autonomous Ukrainian republic. So moving on now to November of 2013 with the Euromaidan protests. These were protests against the Ukrainian government's decision to not sign an agreement with the EU and instead have closer ties with Russia. These protests went until February 2014, with February 18th to 20th seeing the most deadly protests in Revolution Square in Kiev. They ended after President Yanukovych signs the agreement on settlement of political crisis in Ukraine, which essentially just said that they would sign the EU agreement. Now, on February 27th, 2014, soldiers appeared in Crimea wearing unmarked green uniforms carrying Russian weapons. Russia denied that they were their soldiers, although Putin later admitted that they were, in a tactic known as non-occupation, in which a seemingly stateless military appears to try to influence and threaten a state. Throughout all of this, Birsik and Olier indicate that the Russian state viewed Crimea as a piece of Ukraine and at the same time a separate territory perceived as a lost Russian land. Moving on now to March 2014, a referendum was held about Crimean separation, and 97% of the vote was in favor of Crimean secession to Russia. The West, however, calls this referendum a sham, and multiple sources indicate that voter turnout that was reported was significantly lower, and the amount of people actually voting in favor of the referendum was also significantly less. Now, in May 2014, separatists declared independence from Crimea after the unrecognized referendum, and Petro Poroshenko is elected president in an election that was not held in the west of Ukraine, so in Russian-occupied or pro-Russian territories. Poroshenko is pro-Western.
Moving on to November 2014, Poroshenko accuses rebels of jeopardizing the peace after Russians re-entered Ukraine after a very short-lived Minsk truce. Now moving on to 2018, Russia continues to ignore sanctions and declarations from the government, and Petro Poroshenko in November 2018 indicated that Ukraine is under a threat of a full-scale war from the Russians. So how is this an imposition of hegemonic power? Well, the argument is that this stems back to the days of Soviet influence, and Crimea's past is at the center of these claims that Crimea is Russian. Russia also wants them for territory to create a more succinct state, wherein Russian-speaking provinces in Ukraine, where Russian is still an official language, are where they're trying to annex and are successfully annexing, such as Crimea, where Russian is the dominant language. There is also a disregard of Ukrainian declarations of independence and their resolves against them, and this is an imposition of Russian politics and governance on Ukrainian territories. Further, the actions of Russia also violate an agreement between Russia and Ukraine, the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, where in exchange for Ukraine giving up nuclear weapons, Russia must respect the territory of Ukraine and not use force against them. Of course, the annexation of Crimea and ongoing war with Ukraine over territory completely ignores this. This also shows an ignorance of the validity and truth of Ukrainian declarations of territorial independence, as well as an influence on their politics and governments through Russian hegemony. Biersik and O'Lear indicate that the construction of Ukraine as a political battleground between the US and the West ultimately reduced the agency of Ukrainians in media coverage of the events in Ukraine. This means that the continued pressure from Russia on the Ukrainian government ultimately meant that Ukrainian citizens were reduced to nothing more than pawns in a much larger political game. In other words, Russian hegemony could continue to bulldoze over the Ukrainian people in their quest to expand their dominance against the West. This annexation is a product of nationalism that builds on an essentialist belief in civilizational uniqueness and a penchant for reclaiming lost prestige. So how does this relate to Coulthard? Russia ultimately ignores Ukrainian non-recognition of Russian territory, and Russians meddling with the referendums that they win indicates that there's an intense ignorance of sovereign nationhood, as Coulthard theorizes, which is seen both in the breaking of the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, but as well in the violent militant action Russia is taking against pro-West Ukraine in their quest for dominance. Crimean identity is only given legitimacy when it is a Russian identity, which echoes Coulthard's idea that the granting of recognition ultimately bolsters the agenda of those who grant recognition, as does nothing for the oppressed group. And finally, the strategic imposition of Russian dominance ultimately reinforces the hegemonic power that Russia seems to maintain.
Ultimately, when two states have different views of their sovereignty and legitimacy, this can lead to a violent political clash. As we've seen through case studies, Coulthard's analysis of the imposition of hegemony on a subaltern group, and in this case, states that are constructed as subaltern, is applicable when looking at modern-day conflicts over territory, no matter what their root is in. Colonial and imperial impositions of power ultimately lead to one state not being recognized as legitimately autonomous or sovereign by another, and this leads to wars and conflicts that render the citizens of these states subject to the identity put onto them by the hegemonic ruler.